Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello, and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today I have a very interesting guest on, Bishop James Long. He is a demonologist, a Catholic priest, and he deals in the paranormal and exorcisms, plus so much more. Bishop Long is an American paranormal clergy who self-identifies himself as an independent Catholic bishop in the United States Old Catholic Church. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky, and raised a Roman Catholic. He knew he had a calling to serve as a priest. His calling to serve as a priest grew stronger as the years progressed. The decision to leave the Roman Catholic Church, and it was a decision he made out of respect for the Roman Catholic Church and his calling, and has devoted his entire life to studying demonology and the paranormal. And now, my conversation with Bishop James Long. And today I have Bishop Long. Welcome, Bishop.
Well, hello, hello, hello.
I'm going to give you a short introduction to my listeners, and then we'll get into the questions. You're an archbishop. You're an author, officiant, performing over weddings over the past 20 years, studied for the Roman Catholic priesthood for over 6 years, appeared in numerous national magazines, TV shows, radio, and the internet, have a doctorate in ministry, a master's of divinity, master's of education, master's of business, a bachelor's of journalism and communications, an associate of philosophy, and you're a demonologist and into the paranormal. You have performed over 30 documented exorcisms and is highly respected in the paranormal community. Wow. Welcome to Ghost in the Valley. I really appreciate you coming on today and sharing some of your stories and your background.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on.
So starting off, what led you or get into the Roman Catholic priesthood, Roman Catholic priest?
Yeah, you know, I knew I wanted to be a priest when I was five. And so it was important for us, you know, for church. And so we went to church every Sunday, but I knew that I had a calling. I mean, there was something, instead of being a firefighter or whatever, I wanted to be a priest. And that's what I've always known. But then I began reading books on demonology at age 9. And I really didn't know a lot of what I was reading, but I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I couldn't stop reading. It was very important for me to continue. And I read as much as I possibly could. That progressed. And later in life, I decided to enter the Roman seminary and I studied for the priesthood. And I could, and of course, keep in mind during this time, I'm still reading books on demonology. So I decided to enter the seminary and I received my minor orders in the Roman Catholic seminary and was about a year and a half away from being ordained a deacon, but decided to join the old Catholic Church. So I was ordained a deacon priest, and then consecrated to the episcopacy. So I have a doctorate in ministry. And as you mentioned, the three masters, education was always important in my family. And so my mother always stressed education. And so that was paramount. Now I serve as an exorcist for the church. Many people are confused as far as what's the difference between a demonologist versus an exorcist. Well, the exorcist by its definition is automatically a demonologist. However, a demonologist is not an exorcist. And so as an exorcist, I perform rituals, rites that a demonologist cannot perform, such as the minor rite of exorcism or even the solemn rite of exorcism. So that really is a laity can be demonologist. And even with demonologists, there's demonologists, there's secular demonologists, and there's religious demonologists. Religious demonologists are individuals who have a calling from God to serve the church and help the church with demonic cases. So they gather all the information and they determine if the evidence warrants the church to get involved. And that's when, you know, I, as clergy, get involved. When the religious demonologists say, hey, we have a case, this is pretty serious, and it needs your attention.
You studied for 6 years for the Roman Catholic Church. And then when you left the Roman Catholic Church and got into the old Catholic Church, had to be a tough decision to leave.
Well, I mean, it was not easy. It was a very, very difficult decision. You got to understand, my mother was a very devout Roman Catholic and incredibly devout. So for me to leave the Roman Church, that was obviously letting her down. And I certainly did. And she was devastated. She was truly devastated. And it wasn't an easy decision. But really, I felt that God was calling me to serve everyone, regardless of their faith or sexual orientation or their age or gender. To me, I wanted to be able to reach out to everyone, regardless of even the path they're taking in life. And so that's why one of the big reasons why I chose not. Of course, it's not easy. You know, with the Roman Catholic Church, you get paid. You know, you get salary, you get a home, you're given car insurance, everything is pretty much taken care of, and it should be, because you know the starting salary for a Roman Catholic priest is $35,000 a year. Uh-huh. Now, sure, everything is taken care of, all your expenses, your food, but at the same time, if you compare the education to, let's say, a Lutheran church or Episcopalians, you know, they get close to $100,000 a year. And so, you know, it's 4 years of undergraduate work and then 4 more years of graduate school. So it's 8 years after high school to be a Roman Catholic priest. So with the old Catholic Church, we don't get paid. There is no salary.
Yeah. My sister, she just retired. She was a pastor of the Methodist Church. Her hands were tied as far as she couldn't marry gay in the church. They were more than welcome to come and put their tithings in the basket, but they weren't allowed to be part of the church. You know what I'm saying? And that's why she retired, because something that you truly believe in, you know, everybody's equal in the eyes of God.
I do believe that. And of course, that doesn't mean that anything goes, right? Mm-hmm. So I still certainly do believe that it's not our place to judge anybody. But I also don't believe that gives the permission for promiscuity or things of the nature of any sexual orientation. So for me, I think there has to be some guidelines and moral codes that you have to follow. So it doesn't mean, well, it's so lackadaisy. You know. But at the same time, we as the church, we're not, we are welcoming to everyone. It, you're right. People, you hear churches say all the time, well, we're welcome to everyone. You know, as long as you put money in the basket, but you can't do this and you can't do that. So you're not really welcoming to everyone, really, is what you're saying. You're welcoming to everyone with restrictions.
It doesn't matter what you are. I mean, everybody's welcome in this church, you know. And I think she probably raised a lot of eyebrows when she took a church that only had like 35 regular attending followers on a Sunday to over 100.
Oh, wow.
She really did a great things for that church, you know. And I was kind of disappointed she retired, but I understand her beliefs. And so let's get another topic. I mean, you were saying about these wannabe demonologists out there.
Oh boy.
That it's a danger what they're doing.
Yeah, it truly is. Because you know what I'm deeply concerned about is that you got these individuals who are playing exorcists and demonologists. And what's even more concerning is that they are performing rituals that they have no business performing. None. So you have people who are claiming to be, let's say, just say demonologists. But the problem is they are performing rites that they have, that they're not ordained clergy. They've not been trained. And because they call themselves demonologists, they think that qualifies you as an exorcist. It does not. And I'm also seeing this. I've been in the paranormal for 35 years. Mm-hmm. So I've been in the field for a long, long time. And I've met a lot of people throughout the years. I'm also seeing a lot of people who claim to be psychic mediums, which I do believe in psychic mediumship. But I am seeing a lot of people who now are call themselves a psychic medium who are all of a sudden now the demonologists. And that really is also very concerning to me. It's because they go to someone's home and they immediately saying, "Well, I feel a demon in your home, and it's going to hurt you, and it's going to kill your children, or it's going to." I have to deal with that because the people then contact me and tell me, "Well, we had a psychic medium come in here. They charged us $200. They walked around, said there's a demon, and that in order to do a clearing, that it would be a $150 more type of ritual that they have to do, you know, humba, and then throw pixie dust around the room." It's just such an abomination. It really is, because these people are taking advantage of individuals who truly are confused and afraid. And I just find that abominable. That really gets under my skin when people do that, because they are preying on individuals who are terrified, who are truly terrified. And for them to, and all of a sudden now they call themselves psychic mediums, and now they're experts in demonology. And I just, it's becoming a major problem within the paranormal community.
One of my next questions is, you know, the dangers of paranormal investigators and psychic mediums trying to perform an exorcism or calling out any spirit, you know, and the dangers of that.
People forget, Acts makes it very clear when individuals, the sons of, you know, the Stephens were going around performing exorcisms in which they had no authority to do so. And they were destroyed. And the demon said, you know, "Paul, I know Jesus. I know you, I don't." And so, but people, for some reason, they think that because, I don't know, they're a psychic medium today, and now they can give a lecture on demonology. And some of these things, it is such, talking about misinformation. I mean, there's such misinformation that's going on now in the paranormal, that it really is becoming a pandemic of itself. It is becoming such a major issue with people teaching about demonology who, number one, have no business teaching about demonology because they've never read one book that actually didn't consist of, you know, someone who got their degree from a Cracker Jack box. Mm-hmm. I mean, or YouTube, for God forbid. But it's they're teaching demonology, and what they're teaching is absolutely incorrect on a theological level, on angelic, and every level they're teaching. There's one person that there's several people going around saying that you don't necessarily have to believe in God to believe in demons.
Oh,
and then people are looking at, "Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's interesting." And I'm thinking, this is blasphemy.
Why is it, do you think, that most leaders of the cloth, either there be Methodist or Catholic or Episcopalian, anything, why is it, and I found this over my past 40 some years of the paranormal, why do you think they don't talk demonology in the church or paranormal?
Paranormal, because they immediately think that everything is a demon. And that is what, for some reason, is being taught. And that is absolutely incorrect. On a theological level, on a biblical level, it is 100% incorrect. Uh-huh. And you get this a lot. I hear this all the time from people saying, "Well, everything is a demon. There's no such thing as spirits. There's no such thing as ghosts. And they're all demons." No, it's not. Read your scripture. Mm-hmm. Luke 24, verse 36 through 51, and Matthew chapter 14, verse 26 makes it abundantly clear that the disciples understood the concept of what a ghost was, because remember Luke 24, it's after Jesus was crucified, he appeared to them, and then they said, why are you, it says here they were frightened and terrified because they thought they were seeing a ghost. Well, what does that tell us? Then it tells us that they have the odd concept of what a ghost is. Now Matthew chapter 14 verse 26, also, when Jesus walked on water, and when the disciples saw him, he was walking on the sea, they were terrified. They said, "It's a ghost." they said again. And then Jesus said, look, touch my hands, touch my feet. Look for yourselves. Ghosts don't have flesh and bones as you see I have. So Jesus himself even acknowledged that ghosts exist. Mm-hmm. Because if ghosts did not exist, then Jesus would have said, guys, don't be stupid. You know, ghosts don't exist. But that's not what he said. So therefore, biblically, we can actually argue just the opposite. So I think people are afraid of what they don't understand, out of sight, out of mind kind of mentality.
Exactly. I bet you raise a lot of eyebrows, though, among your peers with your teachings.
Well, I do. But the thing is, I back it up with scripture. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I don't do is people are talking about, well, demonology and all that. Well, if you don't believe in possession, then you're calling Christ a liar. And if you want to call Christ a liar, then that's on you. But it's very clear in Jesus' ministry, scripture talks quite often about possession and demon possession. Do you know there are 58 verses in Bible about exorcisms? So the idea that now we're going to dismiss it and say it's just nonsense, it's all mental illness, well, then you're calling Jesus a fraud. Remember, Jesus commissioned his disciples to go cast out demons, mm-hmm. to forgive sins, to work the miracles. He descended the Holy Spirit upon them, and then he told them to go, and he commissioned them to do this ministry. So therefore, either Jesus is a fraud or Jesus was telling the truth. So which one is it? You have to make that decision. Each person has to. I have made the decision that, in fact, that possession does exist based on what I've seen, and that I do believe in this ministry, and it's biblical. So anyone who tries to deny it is calling Christ a liar.
Here's a million-dollar question. yep. What is the difference between demonic infestation, demonic possession?
Oh, big difference. Huge. It starts with infestation. So really, when we're talking about, there's two types of demonic activity. There's what's called ordinary demonic activity and extraordinary demonic activity. Now, ordinary demonic activity is when the demonic will use your weakness to cause you to sin. Now, that's called ordinary demonic activity. So let's say you have a weakness for lust. The demonic will amplify the desire for lust and cause you to sin, whether commit adultery or something else. Or let's say whatever sins that you, whatever weaknesses that you have, it will amplify that. Now, extraordinary demonic activity is when you're getting into what's called demonic infestation, oppression, possession. There's more to it, though, than just the simplified three words there. Mm-hmm. Demonic infestation is, let's say you're a paranormal investigator. You go out. Is there anyone here? Can you make a noise? Can you do something? And now you have an attachment. So the demonic has attached itself to you. You go home, and now you have infestation. Now you can do it also. You can play with a Ouija board. And you can invite this demonic into your home, and you have infestation. Infestation is when that there's a demonic that's present. So there will be religious objects that are desecrated, bangings on the wall, animals are terrified, the smell of sulfur or rotten flesh often happens. It's an overwhelming sensation of dread. It's just very intense. Then the demonic focuses on the victim. And that's when you have what's called demonic obsession and demonic oppression. Now, demonic oppression is when it physically attacks you. And at this point, it's trying to break down the will. So we're not talking about sleep deprivation. We're past sleep deprivation. You're so sleep deprived that your body is at a very weakened state. It begins to bite you and pinch you, hit you, scratch you. Sometimes in incubus, succubus cases, it will attack you in that nature. And it's constant. There's no relief. The whole purpose of that is to break your will. And then you have demonic obsession. Now, this coincides with demonic oppression, and that the demonic will begin to interact with you. And it's breaking down the intellect, making you think that you are alone, that no one is going to help you, that you're sick, that they're going to throw you in an insane asylum and leave you there for the rest of your life. So you actually begin to hear the voices. It mimics schizophrenia. Now, the purpose of this is to break down the intellect and will so that the person can no longer fight. They isolate themselves from the very people who want to help them. And they completely isolate themselves. I mean, we're extreme introvert. So the will and the intellect is eradicated. The person can no longer fight. They're at a very compromised state. And that's when you have possession, where the demonic then controls the body.
And you're talking about how a spirit can attach themselves to you and mm-hmm. carry it to another location.
Yeah, one of the biggest concerns that I have with paranormal investigators, and I've been teaching this now for 20 years. I'm still teaching. At paranormal conferences, I always say this to people, you know, you please understand the difference between provoking and inviting. You know, when you go into a place and you are, is there anything here? Or can I dare you to do something? I dare you to push me. I dare you to, okay, you're not provoking. That's not provoking. That's inviting. There's a big difference between provoking and inviting. What you have just done is beat your chest, look like a gorilla, and now you've just invited this demonic to attach itself to you. And the demonic is looking at you and saying, oh, I will. You know, I'm going to touch you. I'm going to attach myself to you. When you're weak and you're lonely, your wife or husband leaves you, you lose your job, you're so lonely, you're so depressed. And that's when they're going to come right back and provoke you. And they're going to take that invitation and they're going to accept it. There's a difference between provocation and invitation. Invitation is beating your chest, telling the demonic to do something. No, you've not provoked it. You've invited. Provoking is when you begin prayer. So when I have the minor rite of exorcism or even the solemn rite, the minor rite of exorcism is an exorcism that is performed on a demonic entity or malevolent spirit that's infested itself within the home. You do not perform an exorcism on a building. That doesn't exist. That's nonsense. You bless a building. You perform the exorcism on a demonic or malevolent spirit. Now, with the solemn rite of exorcism, that is an exorcism, the very sacred rite, that is performed on an individual who is possessed by the demonic. It's very rare, but it does occur. Now, through both of those cases, there is provocation. And the provocation is when the exorcist begins with the litany of saints. So we're calling upon all the litany, the saints above in heaven, the angels to be with us at that moment, because it is not just the exorcist that is combating this demonic. It is the exorcist who's standing in persona Christi alongside with the angels, alongside with the saints. So we chant the litany of saints. We are provoking the entity to manifest itself and the exorcism continues.
And you had mentioned about inviting them in, like, you know, the Ouija board. What's your thoughts on that?
I am so sick and tired of the Ouija board. I cannot tell you how many cases I've had. It bothers me because for a lot of reasons, people should know by now, because there's been a lot of people who have said the Ouija board is bad news. So this is not, this is not something that is like groundbreaking. All of a sudden, I've never heard of this before. People have heard this before. The Ouija board, there's nothing good that comes from a Ouija board. Nothing, absolutely nothing good. And because that is directly communicating with the spirit world in which you have no idea who you're communicating with. And I'm so sick and tired of these people saying, oh, no, I can filter out the good from the bad. No, you cannot. You're not sprinkling fairy dust on the board and filtering out the bad from the good. It doesn't work that way. No, you can't do it. You can't prove that you can do it. So therefore you don't. That really irritates me because it's misleading people, because it gives them a false sense of security. So they, oh yeah, I can bless this board and then you can do it. And only good things will come through. That is the biggest bunch of crap. Don't believe that. Don't, because it's not true. It is not. And I can tell you for a fact, it's not true, because I've had an individual who said that, in fact, they have this gift where they could bless the board and only good things come through. And all hell broke loose in this house after they used the Ouija board. Mm-hmm. So it's nonsense. It's utter nonsense. The idea that you can filter out the good from the bad, it doesn't work that way. It just simply doesn't. You jump in the ocean and you're going to be swimming with sharks. You can't say, now only the nice little sharks swim by me. It doesn't work that way. The whole purpose of the Ouija board, the whole intent is to make communication with the spirit world. That's the intent of the Ouija board. And what bothers me is that now they're advertising towards children. So now you go to the kids aisle, you know, in games, and you'll see Ouija boards there many times, mm-hmm. where there's blue for boys and pink for girls. And it's very concerning, troubling, nothing. Absolutely nothing good comes from using a Ouija board. Nothing.
All my years doing this, I've only come across two cases that were demonic. It started with the Ouija board and it led to voodoo, to black magic.
Yeah.
Getting deeper and deeper and deeper.
Yeah.
Like, I agree with you, you know, people treat this Ouija board like it's a kid's game and anybody can just play it and you don't know what you're dealing with.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most famous cases in the world, Roland Doe, it all started with a Ouija board. It all started with a Ouija board. And I cannot tell you how many cases of I have had that I have had to go into the home because it all started with a Ouija board. And it just, and people will always say, well, what about the demon giving its name and all this? Let me give you a little hint. A demonic entity will never willingly give you its name, never under any circumstances. So the idea that you're going to play with a Ouija board and the demon is going to tell you its actual identity, you're fooling yourself. And the demonic is actually fooling you because then you're, for example, many times the demonic will pretend to be a child. And it's a six-year-old child. She's a little girl, a little boy, or whatever. Oh, they're so cute. And what's your name? And and then all of a sudden, the demonic, you have no idea the demonic is toying with you. Because it's like a rope. And you grab onto that rope and the demonic is pulling in closer and closer and closer. And that's exactly what the demonic, they are not stupid. They know the weakness of man. They know the sins of man. And they certainly know how to manipulate our weaknesses. And they do this many times by portraying themselves as children, as innocent, as loving, or even as our deceased relatives. So just look, the Ouija board is pure evil. There's nothing good that comes from this thing. I will never, ever use one. I actually have quite a few that I've taken from homes in my storage facility because I get people constantly telling me, you know, we bought a Ouija board, we brought it home, and now it's going crazy. We need you to fix this problem. Well, I'm not the one who started the problem in the first place. And then they command me as if I'm their employee or even slave, that I'm supposed to drop everything that I'm doing, get in my private plane somehow that I apparently must have, by I don't know that I have one, but apparently they think I own a private plane where I can just jump in the plane and head to wherever. And it doesn't work that way. Can't do it.
I heard on another podcast that you were on, you had mentioned something about an exorcism you performed in a woman with a baby.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She had a little boy. Well, she had done some things that she shouldn't have done, you know, in her, earlier years, in her teen years, and playing with Ouija boards and dark witchcraft and things, really getting into heavy stuff and just things that she shouldn't have done. But she, you know, in her mind, they were just playful things, just silly little things that teens do. She didn't really think much of it. She grew and she got into a relationship and she had a little boy. He was a 4-year-old boy, and he was very playful. He loved life, and he was the center of her world. And but he kicked the ball out in the street, and he got hit by a car, and unfortunately he had passed away from his injuries, and that obviously devastated her. I mean, she was inconsolable, and so it was terrible. It was terrible being her for 2 days. She was having a really hard time. But then it was like someone had flipped the switch, and she was happy and talking about her child in the present tense. And the family thought, at first they thought she obviously was in such a grieving state that she was losing her mental faculties, that she was having a complete nervous breakdown. So they asked me they called me in because she was in his room on his bed, and she looked like she was holding something, and she was singing his favorite lullaby. And so I went to the home, and privately I kind of looked at her. Yeah, I kind of opened the door and I saw that she was doing us. So she wasn't doing. She had no idea that we were watching. She had no idea that we were viewing. And I, because where the room was, you can't really see that door. And but she was there, and it was late at night, and she was singing his favorite lullaby, and she was talking to him, and it was clear it was not an act. I mean, she didn't even know we were there. And I snapped a picture, but my phone was quiet, so she didn't hear anything. And I shut the door. We have a picture of her holding what appears to be a full body apparition of a child. And you can clearly see the outline of this child. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. I have never seen a full body apparition like this in my entire life. What was eerie is that I saw a picture of her son who had passed away, And I compared it to that of this thing that I saw that she was holding, this apparition. Very similar. I mean, the haircuts, the style, the shape, everything was very, very, very similar. His head was kind of tilted towards the door, which was interesting because, you know, she was seeing to him, but he was looking at us. So he mm-hmm. was aware, even though she was not aware, and there were no eyes. We couldn't see the eyes. And so I began prayer. And that's when activity began to be quite violent and religious. There was a cross that had just flung across the room. And I knew that at that moment, a temperature change, I mean, it was overwhelming that we're dealing with a demonic. And it was, unfortunately, the demonic that probably took that invitation when she was playing with the Ouija board and doing some other things she shouldn't have done. So yeah, it was terrible. It was terrible. Yeah, it was that she got really heavy into some black magic and to black witchcraft. And
all right, when you do an exorcism, do you do this on your own or are there others that help you?
No. I never, ever would perform the solemn rite of exorcism by myself. Never. Uh-huh. First of all, it's a process. It's a lengthy process. It's not something that, you know, Father Gary Thomas, I've had the opportunity to speak to him a couple of times. He is the Roman Catholic priest who the movie that is after. And, you know, one thing he says, and it's true. He says, I will not perform an exorcism on command because you can't, because there's a protocol. You have to have the psychological evaluation. You need to know the medicines that the individual is taking. You need to know the history, the medical history. You have to, because there are some medicines that causes hallucinations. Some, you know, you have dissociative identity disorder. It creates another personality if you perform an exorcism on them. Or if they're paranoid schizophrenia, you could put them in a paranoid state, a manic state. So there are things that you got to be very, very careful about when you're performing an exorcism on someone who perhaps might have a mental health issue. So we require psychological evaluation. I mean, that's non-negotiable. Uh-huh. I don't even get involved with a case. If anyone ever tells me I'm possessed and I need you here, the very first thing I'm going to say is you need a psychological. Well, I really don't think I need one. Again, if you want me to get involved, if you want the church to get involved, you have to have one. We can't even negotiate. We don't go any further. The conversation doesn't go any further. And it's not because I'm being difficult. It's because I am not trained in mental health. And I don't want to accidentally, while I'm speaking to this person, I don't want to affirm perhaps a delusional thought that the individual is having. So I don't want to do damage to the person if we're dealing with a psychological issue. And that's what you have to be very careful about and very mindful. So while I may be having a perfectly respectful and kindful and pastoral conversation with this information, with this person, I could be feeding into her delusion or his delusion accidentally. And I don't want to do that. So that's why I have a very strict policy that the minute someone says I'm possessed, you have to have one. So, but I also have a medical team that's there. I have someone trained in the medical field that can monitor the vitals of the possessed. I'm not trained in the medical field. Mm-hmm. And I need to know if the person is going into a heart attack or stroke. I need to know this. I need to know what the oxygen level is, what the blood pressure is. I need to be informed because possession takes a major toll on the person on the intellectual level and on the physical level. So the body has been broken down. The body is at an already very compromised state. So now you perform this rite, which is very strenuous on this individual, where the demonic is still continuing to attack the body. The body can only sustain so much trauma. And so this is the dangers that I have. This is the frustration that I have with people playing exorcist, because one day they're going to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. And you did. You shouldn't have been playing exorcist, and you should have had someone who's there medically. You shouldn't have been doing what you're doing. So there's some real serious dangers that go along with performing this rite.
I like the fact that you have a well-trained team with you, you know, that works with you.
Oh, yeah. Have to.
What is the difference between the United States Old Catholic Church and the Roman Catholic Church? I'm not educated at all in the Old Catholic Church.
And a lot of people aren't, and there's a reason for that. There's an explanation, a very logical explanation. Well, basically, the Cliff Notes version. The church in the Roman Pope Leo XIII gave the church in Utrecht in Netherlands complete autonomy because the Pope couldn't come back and forth to consecrate bishops. So the Pope gave them autonomy so that they could consecrate their bishops, ordain their priests, and they were autonomy. I mean, they built a very wealthy community with buildings, and but remember, the money never came from Rome. It came from within. So they built the community. So then Rome decided, well, they wanted the money, mm-hmm. and so about 15 years later, they said, okay, well, now we want all your money, and we want your property, and you need to sign that over. And the church in Utrecht said, now wait a minute, hold on. You get Pope Leo XIII gave us complete autonomy, that the money would stay with us for the building, for the community. That was the agreement. And the Roman church says, no, you're heretics if you don't agree to this. Now, heresy was a very serious crime to be charged of. And so, they stuck to the guns. But there was a lot of things that the Roman church did that was really disturbing in trying to set them up and the leadership up so they could take, quite honestly, the ownership. And so then the Pope declared himself infallible. And so he said, well, I'm infallible. And so then, therefore, you can't argue with the Pope on certain matters. And the church in Utrecht said, no, there's no man that's infallible, only Jesus Christ. And that because basically they felt that the Pope was overreaching, that he was trying to gain again secular power and power to control the church. And so they were just called a bunch of heretics by the Roman church. And there was a split in 1890s over several issues. And so that's how it started. Now, the Roman church does acknowledge the ordinations of the old Catholics as long as you can show your apostolic succession. As a matter of fact, there is a article written called Dominus Jesus. It was written by Pope John Paul II and ratified by Ratzinger, who's Pope Benedict. And it says that any church that shows apostolic succession is considered validly Catholic. And so I can show my apostolic succession to Peter. In other words, Peter laid hands upon this apostle laid hands upon that apostle. So the Roman church does acknowledge our rights. They were a schismatic group, but they do acknowledge. And the problem with the Roman Catholic, with the old Catholics, and there are issues, is that you have some old Catholics that are very liberal, and you have some that are very, very conservative, ultra conservative, and then you have some moderates. And we don't have a Rome. We don't have a Pope. Each bishop is responsible for their own jurisdiction. So each church community then is supposed to create their own canons and the leadership. But the problem with the old Catholic church is that you have a lot of bishops, unfortunately, that are not properly formed, spiritually or academic. Mm-hmm. And that's concerning to me, because how can you then train your future priests, your seminarians, if you yourself are not trained? I find that problematic. When you're in the seminary, you get what's called academic formation and spiritual formation, and you learn both. It's very, very important. And you have bishops who are consecrated bishops who have no business being consecrated bishops, because some don't even know how to spell the word Catholic, let alone teach the doctrine. And that's a problem. We don't have an overseer, I think, if you will, to identify valid old Catholic church versus invalid, meaning that they'll ordain anybody with a pulse. And unfortunately, they do. Some do.
So you don't have any board of directors that oversees?
Each church does. Remember, each jurisdiction would on how they set up their canons and how they set up their bylaws, et cetera. However, no, there is no one place like Rome that that sets the rules and regulations. And so that's why you have some ultra-conservative old Catholics who will not ordain women under any circumstances, let alone allow women to enter even close to the sanctuary, who only perform the Latin Rite. Then you have some ultra-liberals who are quite dangerous, because I don't consider them. I mean, when I say ultra-liberal, they have completely changed the Eucharistic prayer. They've changed the Mass to the point where it's very pagan. And it's heretical to extreme notions. It's not Catholic at all. And I think both are dangerous. Both are very dangerous because they're both extreme. You have extreme ultra conservative. Well, they can be very dangerous, and extreme ultra liberal. That can also be very dangerous, because then you just dismantle the Eucharistic prayer, the Mass itself. So that is a major problem. You have bishops that ordain people who have no business ordaining them. You have people who, you have bishops who are not trained. They're not formed. They have had no philosophical training. They have had no theological training. And that's an unfortunate. And we don't get paid.
Wow.
You know, so there's the, we literally pay for our own, you know, we support our own ministries through our own checks, through our own money. So we don't get a paycheck. And so I've been doing this now, this ministry for 20 years, traveling all over the United States, and I pay for it out of my own pocket.
So in other words, your church could be more liberal or than another of the old Catholic Church, right?
I think, yeah. If you have the ultra conservatives who would consider us liberal, and because we acknowledge what's called the Novus Ordo liturgy, which is the Vatican II installed. And of course, they would consider us liberal. And some of them would even consider us invalid because we use the Novus Ordo, but we also acknowledge the Latin Rite. Mm-hmm. So we acknowledge both rites in the liturgy. So it just depends on the community. But there are some communities that believe that Vatican II, anything Vatican II, past Vatican II, is completely invalid, which I disagree with.
So that was my question, was I've heard of the old Catholic Church, but I didn't know too much about it.
Yep.
I don't know if there is even any in my area.
Probably isn't. Because remember, we are not given buildings. Mm-hmm. We start from scratch, from nothing.
So do you have a building?
I used to. Mm-hmm. We used to have a church building in Louisville, and we work with Calvary Lutheran Church in Louisville. The Lutherans were wonderful, and they were fantastic. And so we had a church there, but unfortunately, it just, you know, they sold it. The Lutherans decided they were going to go ahead and sell it. So I would like to have another parish, mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, I am really, really tapped for time. I people say that often. They often say this, but I'm doing 14 to 16 hours a day as a volunteer chaplain at the hospital. Uh-huh. And then you have, as a presiding archbishop, I have to teach seminarians. Then I have the Benedictines. Then I have the Bible study. Then I have my other ministry. It's just too much.
You also travel outside the area on your own dime, right? I mean, you need donations to go where you got to go and help the women. I seen on one of the social medias here that mm-hmm. you help battered women and people in need. So that does take time and money and transportation and cost. And I do want to put all those links in the bottom of this podcast where people can actually donate to your cause.
And they would appreciate that, because unfortunately the donations that I bring in and the money that it costs per month, it is not even close mm-hmm. to, I wish it was, but it wasn't, but that's the ministry that I've chosen. I'm blessed. I work, I teach online English. So I don't make a lot of money, but I make enough to where I can support the ministry as much as I can. So I live a very simple life. And I think because I've taken vows as a Benedictine. So, you know, simplicity is important for me. Now, if I were living in a lavish lifestyle, that I would have to get rid of all this ministry, because I simply couldn't do it. But I'm very devoted. I have been doing now homeless ministry for a long time. I go to homeless camps and pass out food and clothes and tents and sleeping bags and the single moms for about 15 years, you know, young mothers who leave an abusive relationship. And it frustrates me because people say, well, why don't they just go get help? Well, they do. But if you've ever been in a situation where you need government assistance, sometimes it could take a month or two, or sometimes even longer before any assistance. It's not going to kick in that day. It just simply doesn't happen. And in the meantime, they need help now. And so that's where we try to come in and help them. And then, of course, traveling to people's homes. You know, it's interesting. People ask me all the time, what's the hardest part about this ministry? The exorcism and the blessing homes and things. The hardest part of this ministry actually is not dealing with demons. That's not the hardest part. The hardest part is being on the phone with somebody who is truly terrified because they're going through hell in their home. I mean, they really are going through some serious stuff and they're terrified. Mm-hmm. They have a family and they're begging you, they're pleading with you to come to their home, but they live, you know, 500 miles away or 800 miles away. I'm in Kentucky. They live in Florida, or they live in Texas or New York or California. And I have to tell them, I can't get to you. There's no way. I can't afford a $1,500 trip right now. Uh-huh. I just can't. That's the hardest part of this ministry, is listening to the defeated sigh of the individual on the other line. That's hard.
And before I get off here, you I see you were an author of a book. It was available on Amazon. Is it still available?
I think so. I don't really push the book very much. Matter of fact, I never push the book, which I'm not a very good businessman. It's interesting. I have a master's of business, but I do. It's somewhere on there, I think, or it might be on my website. I'm not really for sure.
What is the name of the book?
Through the Eyes of the Exorcist. Best way to go, I think, is on my website. That because you could get it right from immediately from the distributor itself. Unfortunately, there have been people who have, I don't know why they do this, but they buy the book and they put it on Amazon. One person put it on Amazon for $600. And I got so angry with that. It's like, how dare you? How dare you? Well, I don't know why they would. It caused me a lot of trouble because people, why are you putting your book on Amazon for $600? And so I got so angry. I went on Facebook and I said, I want you guys to see how ridiculous this is. Now, this person is doing this. I don't know who they are, but shame on them for doing it. Contact me and I'll give you the free PDF version of the book. So I did. And I gave over, I think, 350 copies of a PDF. Because it's not to me, it's never been about money. I mean, maybe that's why I don't have a church building. Because, but it never has been about money. I really just try to stay away from that and focus on the ministry. And if people want a copy of the book, I'll give it. If they don't have the money, I'll give it a copy of the book. That's not important to me. What's important is spreading the message of the gospel, which I do every Wednesday at Bible study, and to try to help as many people as I can.
And there's a Bible study available online?
It is. They can go on my Facebook page every Wednesday from 8 to 10, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Every Wednesday, it's at, and you can go to my Facebook page, and I have several. I understand I have several, but it's facebook.com/ Bishop James Long. Make sure to spell the whole Bishop James Long out, all one word, of course, and they can go right to the profile, and it starts every Wednesday at 8 p.m. And then, of course, Friday, we have the Paranormal Friday. And that show starts at 7, and they can, again, go to the Facebook page, and they can enjoy the show then.
And that's Eastern Standard Time?
Both Eastern, yeah.
They can go to the website, your website, bishopjameslong.com.
That's it.
Maybe donate also?
Sure. Yeah, they can go to bishopjameslong.com, scroll all the way down to the bottom. They can donate to whatever ministry they like. Also, want to remind people that we have night prayer. We have night prayer every Monday through Friday. And this is the same night prayer that I was trained in when I was studying for the Roman Catholic priesthood. And I loved it. No matter what kind of day I had in the seminary, was stressful day, whatever it might be, I had the opportunity to pray night prayer. And it's Monday through Friday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's only 15 minutes. And so, but you have to go to spreaker.com/show/night prayer. Again, and if you forget, no big deal. Just go to my Facebook page. I always post it there every day. I post the link, and it's spreaker.com/show/night prayer. Night prayer, all one word, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard. Everyone's invited.
Well, Bishop James Long, thank you for being on the show. I really learned quite a bit, and I thank you very much for taking your time. And I know your time is so valuable to come on the show and share your thoughts and wisdom.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you so very much, and many blessings to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Bishop James Long, for taking time and sharing your stories. I will put the link at the bottom of this episode to please check out the shows that the bishop is broadcasting and donate if you can. The money definitely goes to a good cause. I'm your host, Al Cooley. I'll see you in 2 weeks with another great episode on Ghosts in the Valley.